episode 78 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Shrepler. This week on the show, I am joined by the Curriculum Resource Specialist at my school, Jackie Ehnenfeld. Jackie is one of the people that practically forced me into my master's program, but she's also one of the best instructional leaders and new teacher mentors I've had the pleasure of working with. Jackie and I talk about being in an Ed Leadership Master's program, her path to coaching, the problems with the public perception of education, the need for parent involvement in schools, why teachers should stop and talk to others on campus every day, demanding the best from your students, and the struggles and compromises that come with our general teacher shortage. So sit back and enjoy episode 78 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Jackie Ehnenfeld. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Shrefler, and today I am joined by someone who I used to call a friend but is now the bane of my existence, as she practically forced me to sign up for a master's program, which podcast listeners will have already heard about at this point. Miss Jackie Ehnenfeld, how are you doing today?
I am well, thank you.
Good,
thank
good. You. I would say thank you for joining me on the show, but mostly I just sort of forced you to do it.
Now we might be even...
No, because this is going to take an hour of your life. Your thing you forced on me is going to take 18 months.
It will, but looking back, you'll be thankful. You'll thank me one day.
I'm not yet.
It's okay.
So, Jackie, you are the, I forget, middle schools call it something differently. It's not a CRT, but it's a CRT.
Essentially, yeah. So, CRT, curriculum resource teacher. I mean, yes, so it's a specialist because it just sounds fancier, but yeah, it's a job that encompasses many, many hats.
Yeah, you do a lot of things. What would you define your primary job roles as?
That's tough. It depends on the day. It depends on the situation and task. Here's that first star story for you. My primary task and job responsibility is to keep teachers teaching the best they can. So at the school that we currently teach in, we have a lot of brand new teachers. And so an overwhelming responsibility is 76 brand new teachers teaching on a campus that we need to support. So first and foremost, that's...
Okay. And obviously that other duties as assigned always kicks in.
Oh, yeah.
And when you're at a school as large as us, the other duties as assigned is a much bigger task than other schools.
Yep, no doubt.
Well, cool. No, I like that. You know, you... I would say in a lot of ways, from my experience here so far, you're very much the backbone of the school. You are sort of the person keeping all the things together in a lot of ways.
Thanks.
Which everyone here is very grateful for, I know, because I don't think a lot of people could handle the responsibilities that you deal with every day. And like I kind of mentioned, you're also in the master's program that I'm in. You are almost finished.
I am. Thank goodness. It's been good. It's been a great learning experience. But holy moly, I will...
You're not going to miss it?
No. I will not miss it.
I already don't miss it, and I'm in it.
Welcome to week, what is it, 6?
Yeah, something like
Yay.
That. Yeah. We're actually recording. I never do this. This is going to air tomorrow. So, like, people are listening to this almost live.
Okay.
As close as live, which is pretty cool. So, but yeah, what has, other than not going to miss it, what has that experience been like for you over the last 18, 17 months, whatever it's been?
It's actually been really... enlightening for reasons I never expected it to be. So, you know, obviously master's work, I'm thinking, you know, higher level content, you know, rigorous coursework, all that good stuff. And I'm not going to say that it hasn't had its challenges. It has. But the greater lesson I think I've learned through this process is the value of learning in non-traditional ways. So my first term was not a good experience. It was we'll leave it at that. And looking while I was in it, it was really, really frustrating. We were a very small cohort of people, and there was really no one to lean on or turn to during that time. And so I left term one incredibly frustrated. By the end of term two, gotten marginally better because I think I'd come to terms with how the process was going to shake down and how it would all work out. But I think in looking back, what I have taken away most from this is learning life lessons in leadership and education in ways that I wasn't expecting to. So what not to do, how not to lead. You know, if you say one thing and then don't follow through, or set one level of expectation and then there is no follow through or accountability, that's hard. And so when you're in a master's level coursework, and your professor, who is pretty high up in a neighboring district, and they don't follow through, that's a tough lesson.
Yeah.
So, and I expected to, I think, learn more from the content, if that makes any sense. And I didn't realize how much I already knew of that. And experience will definitely cover that. You know, the books are great. Some of them are really, really fantastic. But life experience and being on the boots on the ground on campus has been way more valuable in terms of what I've learned in leadership than the coursework that we've done in the program. So,
and I think that's been my struggle, and so far has been that and granted, it's been 3 weeks of class or whatever. It's been 3 or 4 weeks. And so, but the material covered thus far, I have not felt like is any sort of what I would think of as graduate level material. I don't think this is unbelievably complicated material. And it's been a struggle to sort of
justify the expense and the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing too, and another colleague actually brought it to my attention somewhere towards the end of term one. It was, this is a means to an end. This is what the state requires, what most states require to, you know, do any type of formal leadership and administration. And so whatever the combination or the culmination happens to be, if this is literally a means to an end to get the degree, to be able to be qualified to influence and impact others, then that, it is what it is. It's an expensive means to an end. You know, that's given, you know, new student loans and so on and so forth. But I guess I'm, looking back, I'm thankful that it wasn't more of a struggle, because education's hard in and of itself. So to not have to struggle, you know, doubly doing the master's work, I think is a blessing in disguise.
Yeah. No, and I think the one plus is so much of the work through the NLU program, and I'm sure that other states have similar systems and stuff in place, but because they partner closely with our district, we're able to do a lot of the work, the quote internship components, during the work day.
That's huge. That's a huge, huge thing that not neighboring districts do not do that. Mm-hmm. That I can tell you, because people in the cohort that I am currently, they don't have that same ability and experience. And it's definitely a hindrance to them. It's a barrier for sure.
Yeah. And I think just to anyone thinking about going into a master's program or considering it, I definitely imagine that it's way more of a struggle if you're still a traditional classroom teacher.
Oh, no,
I can't imagine trying to get all the coursework and everything else, not even the coursework, but as much as like the internship components and everything else. You know, we have assignments that are due week 4 or 5 that you need to have practical plans in place for working with a team as a leader. If you're a traditional classroom teacher and have not done that before, you're that's a first, second year teacher, that's going to be a struggle just to coordinate.
Whereas we're
sitting there going, well, I just can pull things I've done yesterday.
That's Tuesday. Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, I think that has come out in class discussion and come out, you know, in the cohort, because there are 4 of us, so it's, you know, pretty tight knit crew. The other thing too, I think that's really difficult for them is that if they're only—I shouldn't say only a classroom teacher. That's unfair. If they are a classroom teacher, their lens is that of a classroom teacher. So much of what they teach you through the program and through probably any master's level program for ed leadership is the lens of a leader and the umbrella view from above. And you just don't have that. You might have, you know, team lead experience, or you might have a departmental scope to look through. But when you're talking about making, you know, systemic changes and plans for a school, and your only lens is what it's like in the classroom, that is a very difficult perspective to maintain. And to not have that clinical experience for the log, for the internship, that's really, really hard. And so answers are narrow. Discussion is very narrow. Perspectives are very narrow when it comes to problem solving. And so to not be able to bounce ideas off of someone else that has a school-wide view it's definitely a hindrance to them.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Well, the program is what it is. It's not entirely what my listeners are here to hear. That was kind of fun. I like words, but I want to get to my regular questions.
Sure.
I do. But I really want to start a little bit about your path first. Just how did you kind of get into this role? How did you end up being the CRS at the largest middle school in the country?
Question. So many, many moons ago. No, I'm kidding. I opened the school. So I moved from a neighboring school that was painfully overcrowded, although not like we are now. Our school now was the relief school for the one that I started at. And my third year teaching, when this school opened, I applied and said, I really, really, really want the experience to open a brand new school. Let's do this. And so I followed the leader no pun intended, and came to open the school and have been here ever since. So that definitely plays a role in my position now. I've seen from when we were small, under 1,000 students, to now triple in size. I've seen from, you know, two subgroups in terms of school data to every subgroup now meeting, you know, the requirements to be tracked and monitored. There's been a lot of change, staff change, just everything. So I think that has helped the experience. But the bottom line really was I, went on maternity leave, and when I came back from maternity leave many years ago, the principal at the time, they needed help in a different area than the classroom I was supposed to go back to. And the sub that had taken over my class was really, really good. And in short, if I had gone back and taken over my classroom halfway through the year, that substitute would have not had a job, and he really deserved to be in the classroom. So I said, what else can I do? Like, what? Where else is the need? So I ended up doing TV production for the rest of that school year. I thought, I can teach anything for 6 months. That's no big deal. Had a lot of fun doing it. And then that, because I, which I guess that's an unusual thing for teachers to agree to do. I don't know. The school needed help. I said, I'll do whatever. And the leader,
I think
the
you
time,
know well enough now to know that that's an unusual thing for a lot
do,
of teachers
yeah,
to do.
Fair. Yeah. At the time, I thought, no, if you need the help and that's what's best for the school, sure, I can help. It's no big deal. Obviously, with the intent to go right back to my ELA classroom the next year. Well, lo and behold, I guess that set something in motion with the principal at the time. And because the situation is what it is, and that was an unusual, I guess, decision that I made, she asked me to come out of the classroom to get into leadership, basically. And the time, the task was right around when we shifted from FCAT to FSA, and the reading and writing test became a combined test overall. And so the task, if you will, was for me to unite the reading department and the ELA department as one, so that they were actually communicating and planning and so on and so forth, because that was a foreign concept at the time. I don't understand why that's the case, but that was many years ago, so we'll leave it at that. And from there, it just sort of grew into, oh, look, she can do more things, so we'll shift her here. So that's why titles to me never really mean anything. It's what task I've been given to take on. So it went from that to testing coordinator //, and then here I am.
Yeah, and like you, I feel like your role now is like is almost the head leadership person. Like you're the one step below admin. It's like admin, and then there's you organizing all of the rest of us to try to actually accomplish anything.
Professional cat herder, I'm sure, is on my signature line somewhere.
Probably. Yeah. Well, your path lines up nicely with the school growth here, simply for the fact that as you got more and more responsibilities, there were more responsibilities to go around.
Sure.
You know, it's one of those where we have, what, 7 instructional coaches now, 8 instructional coaches, which there are still schools in this district that have one. And there are schools in this country that have 0. You know, there are plenty of schools where it's a principal and an AP, and that's it.
And I can't imagine functioning that way.
Not even close. And now we're running with 7, 8 instructional coaches, and all while we're specialized, working together as a team and able to do those things. And that's just, I think, you know, speaks to the leadership here, but also your ability to cat wrangle, as it were, you know, and keep us all online and where we need to be.
I try. I mean, obviously it's a growth and a learning curve for me too, because I've never done this particular role before. You know, I've never been in a school. I mean, we've had reading coaches, we've had math coaches, we've had, you know, situational 1 or 2 coaches here and there. I've never been in a school where there's been an opportunity for an entire suite of resource people to get together and collectively help.
And we don't all fit in one room.
And we don't actually all fit in. Yeah, so that's another thing. So, but, you know, nevertheless, I think we have a hugely talented team, with everyone having very definite strengths of their own. And to be able to pull those strengths together to help teachers, that's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge.
I like to believe we're getting that job done, at least most days.
But no one's quit yet.
That's true. I'll allow it. All right. I think we got a good picture. I think we have an idea of who you are, and that'll lead us nicely into my first question, which, of course, my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Today, on Monday, the 21st of February. Okay, so
and it's Thursday.
Oh, it is That's the kind of week I've had. Okay, yeah. So, God, please edit that out. All right. So
no, that's staying for sure.
Awesome. Yeah, so that, what world do I live in? The world where time ceases to exist and my calendar
days of the week are irrelevant.
Days of the week are all just, you know, questionable and negotiable. I honestly, if you had asked me this question over the summer, I probably would have not given this answer. But my gut is absolutely telling me right now, our biggest problem facing education is public perception of public education. I think that is really digging down to the core of what I think is wrong in general, and everything I think can be connected back to the way the general public perceives education and what it is and what it isn't and what it should be and what it should not be. If it was not so, our governor would not have decided to put someone in charge of public education that has absolutely no background in public education.
Our president wouldn't have done the same thing, so.
Fair, yeah, well, that's a whole, yep, we could go there too. So I think that's huge. That's a huge, it goes, I think, well beyond our district, well beyond our state, and you're right, it's a systemic problem in the nation, but I think taglines and headlines are what rule the general perception in the public. And so they see a tagline like, oh, Common Core, I'm going to take away Common Core. What does that actually mean? That's not, but by golly, parents, it's a bandwagon token phrase. And so, oh yes, Common Core is bad. Yes, he is a good governor. So it's little, that's actually quite a big thing, but things like that happen repeatedly that shape the way the public views or feels about public education without really knowing what's going on in the schoolhouse.
And I think you bring up probably the most perfect illustrative example, because this is a humongous problem. But just to give some color to what you just said, our new governor in the state of Florida, Rick DeSantis, recently announced that he has decided, based on what he heard on the campaign trail from parents, that he is going to eliminate Common Core in the state of Florida. Well, number one, we don't actually have Common Core in the state of Florida.
Exactly.
We have the Florida State Standards, which are actually not Common Core. They are Common Core for the most part, plus cursive, but and a semicolon in fifth grade. But they mostly are Common Core, almost
right.
entirely. So, okay, I'll allow it. Fine. But there's no plan for what to replace it with.
Mm-hmm.
There's no admission of the millions of dollars we spent to add cursive and a semicolon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about nothing to replace it with. I mean, we have no idea what that means. And like all things, and I've said this on the show a million times, it's not the idea that's flawed, it's the implementation. There's nothing wrong with Common Core.
I was just going to say, so what was wrong with the standards that required them to be wiped off the table? And just, like, that's the part that I just
don't
understand.
Well, parents don't understand this new math.
yeah, okay, so that's a whole different discussion we can hit up another day. However, you're right, that's a perfect example. It has nothing to do with the standards are not the problem. That's not it. That's not it at all.
It's not like we're not – you could make the argument that by removing the standards, you reduce the workload on teachers.
Sure.
But we're not just going to get rid of standards. We're going to replace them.
They're going to replace
which now requires
something.
New training to
yeah.
learn the new standards. You're actually not reducing the workload on teachers. And if you're going to think that the problem is the standards aren't the problem. But you're right. That awareness of the public is
yep.
lacking.
Yep. And all they can think is, why do I have to spend 20 minutes multiplying, you know, two-digit – you know, that is the issue. And so because that the perception is it's bad, it that then carries weight and continues. And that's what gets repeated over time.
So I saw a tweet last week or this week, and I wanted to see if I could try to find it while we're talking, but I can't. And it lines up perfectly with this.
Okay.
And the tweet was essentially two questions. And it said, what is it that you think of when you think of a phenomenal educator?
Mm-hmm.
And question number two is, what is it that people think of, the public think of when they think of a phenomenal educator? And sort of the general response was, you know, as a single educator, it was very much, I think of personal, you know, driven to help students, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the public thinks of sort of the movie version of sort of giving
yeah.
up their lives and self-sacrificing and everything else.
Sure.
And someone made the comment that there's a huge disconnect there. And as teachers, we often don't feel empowered to publicly speak to that disconnect.
No doubt. I completely agree with that. And then the other frustrating thing, one of the many frustrating things then, is if the public, the general perception of teachers are these heroic, you know, actors and actresses that are in movies, then if they're self, you know, working their crazy hours and doing whatever they can and making all these sacrifices for kids, then why doesn't the public value teachers more if that's what they think we do?
Well, I don't know if that's what they think we do. I think they believe that's what we should do. And that's not what they're seeing from their kids' teachers.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, again, I gotta think where to go with this because if parents spent more time on campus in classrooms helping and trying to find ways that their own individual skills and skill set could benefit public education, time, effort, in some cases, financial resources for things that would give different opportunities for students' experiences. If they spent more time and effort and energy in that route in schools, we wouldn't have the issues we have. Because then the public perception would be driven by people that are in schools from a parent view or from a community view. And I think that will be a good first step in changing public perception.
So as a solution, or at least as a starting point, an outreach system,
for
you know,
sure.
we have a process for that. We have parents on campus at our school all the time, but I will say in my experience in teaching, this is the first school where I've seen that heavy of a parent presence on campus. You know, I don't think I see that. And maybe it's, I've never been in elementary, and I'm sure that in elementary schools it's more common, I believe, in my head at least. But I don't think I see that at other schools. You know, we have parents on campus for, you know, helping with translation. We have parents helping at lunch duty sometimes with trash cleanup. Mm-hmm. We have parents here almost every day running our swag booth and selling, you know, school swag. And we have teacher parents in classrooms that I see supporting teachers. And that's just, we have parents of teachers in classrooms. And it's amazing to me that we have that kind of involvement, and that's really cool. I just wonder, number one, why isn't that happening in more places?
Sure.
Number two, is that actually changing the perception in our area that this is a school full of phenomenal teachers?
One, I don't know why that doesn't happen more often unless you have an actual community school where it's required, and the setup is such that the whole system's aligned to help that particular school be successful and the kids and the families be successful. But two, research from all different countries, all different walks of life, all different levels of schooling, research consistently shows that parental involvement has a direct and positive impact on student achievement. So it's not logical to me that more schools wouldn't come up with a system and develop a way to ensure the greatest amount of parental involvement. That just doesn't make sense to me. For me here at our school, I think one of the greatest benefits that we have, and it was an untapped benefit, I think, looking back, we have an unusual high number of parents who are coming from other countries who are not able to work or have very limited or very tight restrictions on how they're able to work. And so they have the ability, financial ability, to not, you know, have to depend on working 2, 3, 4 different jobs. And they're able to come and volunteer. So it just... the other part of it is having someone at the school reach out and say, hey, this is what I need. What can you do? And so this year, started last year, but this year was really heavily on sending out the surveys to the teachers. Hey, when do you need help and what do you need help with? And then sending out a very similar survey to blasting it through social media for parents, through SAC, through PTSO, through anyone that comes on campus to have them fill out the survey so that it can match skill sets. And that's huge. And I think if parents are told specifically what you need help with and they think, oh, I can do that, instead of this big loose, I'm just going to go volunteer at the school. No, I need help translating. Like, these children coming from Venezuela don't understand that to bridge that gap between the school system there and the school system here, or students coming from Brazil. It's a vastly different school system. And so they need to be able to have that transition time so they're more successful. And so if teachers need help and parents are willing, it's just a matter of matching up the skill sets. And that it's tedious. I mean, it's a tedious process. But if we say we need help and then we don't actually take the help or strategically place the help, then what? I don't know. I don't know.
I like that. I like that as a solution, though. I like that as a starting point of you know, getting parent involvement, because I do struggle with this disconnect between what people think we do and what people do, what we actually do, and sort of, you know, the news is never on our side for the most part, so they're always giving the negative spin, you know, and so I think it's a good idea if we're going to start with fixing the problem, and we can't, as teachers, feel comfortable speaking our own minds in public, then that outreach component could be a good workaround or way to get in avenue to start that out. My second part of that was, do you feel that that is having an impact? So, I mean, obviously the parent help is helpful to the students right here in front of us. Sure. Is the parent help helping the perception?
So I can give a couple of very specific examples. One of them, the because community talks, the parents talk, especially if they don't really know and it sounds crazy and sensationalist, then they spin whatever. Social media can be the devil sometimes. However, the perception at some point, not that long ago, was we're so overcrowded, it's dangerous, it's unsafe, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the parents that came to volunteer said, well, we could really use help. You brought up the example in the cafeteria. You want to help in the cafeteria? Sure. And they kind of looked, you know, sideways at us a little bit. The minute they got in the cafeteria and realized, okay, yeah, it's a lot of kids, but highly organized. They were well-behaved. There was a system in place. You know, we're able to spread out to the courtyard and to the portable cafeteria and have, you know, systems in place. Then those parents were the conduits to go back to the community and say, I hear what you're saying, but I'm there 3 days a week, and that is not true. It's flat out not true. And this is my firsthand experience telling you you're not right. So if you're not sure, come volunteer. Oh, you don't want to volunteer. Okay, well, I'm going to need you to stop, you know, lying, basically. And, you know, that's, again, a very isolated instance, but that's same type thing. It's firsthand experience, and it's not coming from the teacher. It's not the school trying to spin the narrative or, you know, say it in a certain way so that it's less damaging in social media. No, it's just come in and see what it is. You want to help? I've got things you can do right now if you want to come volunteer. Just give me time. Yeah. And so I think that's, you know,
yeah,
part of the solution.
I like it. I like it as a solution. It's good. It's a good plan. Yeah. And I mean, certainly I've talked about on previous episodes when I've had Mr. Jackson on and Dr. Walker and some other people about how much this school has transformed just in the area with among other teachers. The sure. The idea of what this school is, it has definitely transformed. And I don't, you know, we can attribute that to a few things. But so, yeah, I think that, yeah, I can see that. I like it. I'm a fan. I approve. Moving on. Stamp of approval. Next question.
I'll take it.
So my next question for all my guests, of course, is what is something you're doing you wish all teachers would do?
Oh, I wish teachers would stop during their day and talk to someone that they either don't know very well or talk to someone that they appreciate to find out how and why they do what they do. And it's part of a reflection piece that I think most people will claim to be too busy to do. And I don't know if this is me as a person, I don't know if this is attributed to the master's program I'm in, but just stopping what I'm doing to pick someone else's brain, just to find out why, and then figure out how I can get better the next time I do something. As small as that might sound, if every one of our teachers took the time to do that every day, pop in a neighbor's classroom or stop and say, hey, what about, or I was doing this and I just to get that conversation going for the idea or the sole benefit of just improving practice and just being, you know, I think that would be vastly beneficial.
Yeah, I think certainly this is a teaching can be a very isolating profession, which is odd given that you deal with people all day, every day, but they're not real people. They're little people. and in middle school, they're little monsters. They're only, especially seventh grade, they're not monsters. Even human.
Yeah,
they're just little. Yeah. But I think that, the isolation of a classroom can be pretty intense. And I struggle with that a lot. I've talked many times on the podcast about how much I struggle with that my first year teaching. And it was exactly that, going and talking to people and building that, not only my PLC, but my friends on campus, I could talk to.
It's hard. I mean, it's we're raising hundreds of children. That's really what this comes down to. And while we have them here for a very limited time during the school year, 180 days, only hours a day, as a village, like it takes a lot. And if you don't have support, you're not going to raise the kids very well. I mean, that's as silly as that might sound. That's what it comes down to. And in talking out or reaching out or just asking like, hey, how in the world can I, those conversations start to build relationships. And that ends up being the foundation of great schools and great communities and great, you know,
I like that. I like that connection. You know, you say it takes a village when you're talking about your one or two children or three children or whatever. It takes a village just to raise your own children.
Sure.
And yet, as teachers, we sometimes try to take on the burden of raising 125 a day.
Realistic.
It's just not. And I like that imagery of it takes a village, because it does connect back to sort of a common sense belief that, you know, it takes help. You can't do this alone. Huh. I like that. That's good. Yeah. And I think the other thing you said is you said talk to someone. You're not specific in talking to another teacher necessarily. And I think it's important we pull outside ideas outside of the classroom, you know?
Absolutely.
I know in a couple of assignments we've done so far, there's always talk about, like, do we only want to pull teachers when we're having committees? Or should we be pulling parents, other students? Should we be pulling, you know, classified staff? Should we be pulling front office people? We need all those stakeholders involved. And I think all of those people have things they can add to our classroom. And I think too often as teachers, we get locked into the belief that only other teachers or the people above us can give us ideas that matter.
There's absolutely not. You can get some of the best ideas from people that don't have any idea what you do. And whether it's someone else on campus or someone else in, you know, outside of school, how just talking it out and talking through the whole problem solution thing. But for me, I on campus, what could teachers do? I wish they would do. I wish they would talk to other people and just be open to other perspectives and other possibilities to better their practice.
Yeah, absolutely. That you know, we throw the buzzword on it, lifelong learning. Lifelong learning.
Yep. The minute, and it's funny, former teacher said, you know, once I questioned, like, how come you're not going to be here? So, I have, you know, this training to go to. Training? What, you know? And of course, this is prior to getting into teaching, so I never quite understood the whole concept. But he said, the day I stop learning is the day I need to stop teaching. I thought, holy, this is why I like you, you know? And that has resonated, had stayed with me my whole life. And this was in high school, and that has stuck with me because if my teacher is still willing to learn, then I need to value learning from him or from her. Yeah, so,
I agree. You know, it's something whenever I do leave campus for whatever reason, if I'm at a training, I always make sure to tell my students, like, yes, I'm at a training. My son gets an absolute kick out of the fact that I'm a student again. He's blown away by
it. Mine too. They're like, mommy has to do schoolwork. So they want to chit-chat about, Wally Kazam or what's going on with Pokemon or what's the Yu-Gi-Oh.
Wally Kazam? I don't think that's a thing.
It's a thing.
That's two different things. Wally and Shazam, they're two different things.
No, Wally Kazam. I can't with you. But they want to chit. No. Okay. What are you doing? This is schoolwork.
I finally have started just saying, I'm doing homework. Doing homework.
And they look at me sideways, like, how many minutes do you have? I'm like, no, I'm not putting my minutes in on these reading programs. This is, okay. So no, that is, it's funny that they still sort of, and this has been, you know, several months I've been doing this now, they still look at me sideways because I'm doing homework.
Good times. All right. We got two down, one to go.
Okay.
Just breezing right through them. The last one, and this is always my personal favorite, is who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
So I get to name names.
You get to name names.
Gosh, this is so tough. Okay. I'm a cheater. I have to cheat on this because naming one, I could give you the quintessential fictional person. But I have very specific faces and names attached to people that were the greatest educators I've ever had. One I had for 2 years in high school, Bob Restivo, had him for geometry as a freshman, had him for calculus as a senior. That man, we joked, only half-heartedly that he had a cot in his storage closet and he just slept on campus because that man was always there. And he demanded the best every single day, regardless of what was happening on campus. It didn't matter where you had come from, how much sleep you had, what was going on. He expected you to be great. Regardless, and how you got there, he was willing to negotiate. But at the end of the day, you had to be the very best. And I had him for 2 years, and I would have never survived calculus without that man. I don't know why I thought I had to take that. As an ELA teacher in life, sorry, Mr. Restivo, I've never used calculus again. But
Restivo was always the go-to. I worked with Restivo at our previous school. And he was always the example someone would try to give when I would say that lecture doesn't work in the classroom.
Oh, it works.
And I said, and they would be like, oh, well, Mr. Restivo does it. I go, are you a god?
Exactly.
No, you're a mortal man. You don't get to do direct lecture for an entire period. Only Bob Restivo can do that.
He's the only
because he's a god.
He's not a human. He can't be human. Second one would have been Dennis Bodenmiller. And
has been mentioned before as the best teacher on this show.
Awesome. I have a feeling I know who may have mentioned that. He, for me, was sophomore English, and he is the reason I teach English. So looking back, up until that point, was not my strong suit. I struggled, you know, all the rules and grammar and all that stuff. Got to sophomore year, and all of that was still expected, but that was not the focus of the class. He taught big picture literature and making connections to life through what we were reading and doing in class. And, you know, maybe it was his... he was probably one of the most laid-back, strict teachers, if that makes any sense at all. And he was one of those teachers that it was an underlying demand of greatness as well. Like he, there was no slacking in the class. It just wasn't allowed. It just was never. And for some reason you wanted to work harder and be better being in his class. I never quite got that because that those words probably never came out of his mouth. I don't know. Maybe it's the Robert Redford connection and somehow like you can't let Robert Redford down. I who knows? But he, and I've told him, I guess he is now since retired.
He's retired. Yep.
That he is the reason he made my mind shift in that content area. And so if he was able to do that for me, then I need to try and be able to do that for other students. So he, for sure. And then, you know, another, and my third, cause I'm going to go with three, is Paulette Stone. So, Miss Paulette Stone taught biology and anatomy and physiology, had her also for 2 years. She was very, very strict, very black and white, very by the book. And somehow that very strict environment, kids never acted the fool. They never talked at a turn. And holy moly, I would, that class, especially for bio, I would say rivaled today's AP bio classes. We didn't have AP bio back in the day, but that I could have probably passed the AP bio test from having been in her class. And same type thing, crazy, crazy high standards, high demands on the students. But I knew for all three of these teachers that they cared about me because they expected great from me. And there was never a negotiation of like, can I turn this in late? Can I not do this? Can I sort? Absolutely not. They had to have the very best out of everyone that they taught. And I think that common thread is what makes them collectively great. But they have left a huge impression on me as an educator and what I expect from every student that came into my classroom.
I don't know a better way to put it than that those phenomenal teachers sometimes just have it.
They have the
it factor. What I struggle with so often, and I'm going to take this in a whole other direction now, but what I struggle with so often is how do you teach that? You know, you work every day with new teachers. How do you teach it?
You don't. So here's also what I firmly believe. There are people who are meant to teach, and there are people who are not meant to teach. It's yes or no. And it's, you can hone your craft and you can get better at a practice, but that it factor of making that fundamental connection with kids and making, without actually saying the words necessarily, but having that absolute standard that kids know that you believe in them, you respect them, you expect them to do great so that they do, and then telling them when they let you down and reminding them you are capable and I need better from you because this is not your best. This is subpar and I'm not taking it. And whatever that best is from that individual student, once the kids realize that you're holding them all to the same high standard, I think that's the key. And I don't know how to teach that to someone who doesn't already believe that in their gut. So we can debate philosophy, we can talk pedagogy, we can go all of this all day long. But at the end of the day, if that person teaching those kids don't genuinely believe in their gut that those kids are capable of more and better, I can't teach that to them. I can't teach that. And you can go in any classroom and walk in and know within seconds what that classroom environment's like, what the relationships are like, and what that teacher expects from those kids. And this goes far beyond their behaving and, you know, sitting down and listening to it. That isn't it at all. You can walk into classrooms that look like sheer chaos, and there is more learning and deeper thinking and harder work happening than in classes that are completely silent in rows, sitting in a lecture, unless it's Bob or Steve-O, and then,
but again,
you know, our
classes of mortal men is
exactly
what we're talking about. Yeah,
exactly.
I think that I don't know that you can teach it. I don't know you can teach it. I think you can learn it.
I think you can learn.
And I think you can go through a number of years of education with teaching without it and somehow find it. Because I feel like that's what I did, is I don't think I had that my first few years of teaching. But I like to believe that I picked it up along the way, or maybe it was buried the first few years, whatever you want to call it. But I feel like I picked it up along the way. If I think back to my first year, especially of teaching, I didn't have a clue. But,
oh, I had a clue about but I came into those doors knowing for sure I cared about kids and knowing that I had to make a connection with kids so that they would listen to me and they would respect what I had to say. Now, what I was saying, God only knows what. It's all a blur. It is totally a blur that first year. But being able to go back and teach that to someone? I don't know. I think you have to see it, and I think you have to see that someone else has it and you don't. Mm-hmm. And then that drive has to come from, how do I get it? How do I do that? How do I mimic that? And that goes back to talking to people, seeing other people teach, getting into, you know, other classrooms, thinking about what empowered you as a student so that you can then do that for your, you know, your own kids. It is not for the faint of heart. Teaching is so definitely not.
I don't know why, but from what we're talking about, this just made me think, looking at the picture as a whole, you know, we have this public perception issue of education. Mm-hmm. We know that, I mean, everybody knows we're not paid what we probably deserve. We work way more hours than are contracted. We do all those things. Even a subpar teacher probably still does a lot of those things. You can name three teachers off the top of your head that had it and were just phenomenal and great. I think all of us can name those great teachers that had it. Are we at a position in education where we just have to have teachers who don't have it but are trying, or that are never going to get it but are still at least making some learning happening? Are we at a supply and demand point where we can't, even within the system, expect every teacher to be at that level?
So I disagree. No, I think if that's where I was, if I believe that to be the case, there's no way I could get into leadership, formal leadership. There's no way. I have to have the same expectations for my teachers that I had for the students that were in my classroom. Now, can I, if a willingness to learn and a willingness to improve, if you're coachable on any level, I'll get you there. Like I can make that happen. I can find people for you to work with, for you to talk, like pair you up with weaknesses, fill in some of those gaps over time, and let it be a constant work in progress, constantly polishing the stone for sure. But I refuse to accept someone who is just getting by, who's just doing the time, teaching the lesson, giving the information. I can't, that we have got to be better than that in education. And that is not, I would never, ever, ever want to put one of my kids in that teacher's classroom because it's better than, I don't know. That's,
Yeah, it doesn't feel comfortable. Like I'm not happy with it, right? Like I don't, but I look at a school our size and we have 170 something teachers, mm-hmm. and there are teachers who don't have it and are never going to have it. Mm-hmm. Some of them are veterans. Some of them are brand new. Some of them will be here next year. Some of them will not. That's just the reality of our picture. But I'm wondering, without some of the other systemic issues being fixed, I don't see how we fix that. Like if people don't like education and they still have this belief that if those who can do and those who can't teach, if that's mm-hmm. still something that's floating around, and yes, there's plenty of us in the profession that are absolutely giving our all and could be in plenty of other places making way more money. And we all hear those things all the time. I get it. Mm-hmm. I just think that there are sometimes a lesser evil of maybe a teacher who's not phenomenal and not even great, but is good getting the job done and some learning is happening,
yeah.
is still better than a full-time sub who's taking personal phone calls in the middle of the classroom.
Okay, I completely agree, because then what's going to happen is that subpar or that mediocre or, you know, 50% or 50 percentile teacher, because then I can surround them with better. And innately, they will get better. Teachers as PLCs, as crews, as departments will lean in on each other and bring that one who's already halfway there, like doing no harm, obviously, and marginal growth and just in the classroom. I'll take that any day over a sub, no doubt. But I'll take that 10 times a day over someone who doesn't want to be there, because I think they'll be surrounded by enough other good teachers who are trying better their practice that they'll either raise the bar for themselves, or they'll be pulled up by their peers, or they'll realize this is not for them and they'll make other decisions. So I think that leaning in, as Jackson Hook always says, we're just going to lean in on them. Some people need to be squished, and it's more than lean. It's a sit on and, you know, force them to see other perspectives. But I think innately people are competitive beings. I think in teaching, there's a competitive nature in general. And I think if you're okay and doing some good and getting by, so you understand what's required, I can challenge that. I can spark something in you to get you to be better. I can't do that with someone who has lost their love for learning and they've lost their love for impacting in children. I can't teach that. I can't teach you to love kids and love teaching kids, but I can teach you how to get better at doing it. So I think if that is the base, I think it's a huge jumping off point. We can go from there. Did that cool. answer? Because yeah. that, it was sort of a two different, like, I...
Yeah, two different thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complicated problem, because we do have... You're all good. It's definitely a complicated problem that is hard to master, and I don't think there is a perfect solution. It's more of a leadership question, I guess, of how do you plan for staffing when you keep that in mind, and you know, when you look at an end of year point, I think we're at that point now where it's like, okay, who are we going to, you know, not that we have the ability to really even cut people for the most part in education, which is a whole different problem or discussion we could have, but who do you think about? You know, do we offer a position back to, do we not offer a position, especially those brand new first 3 years where we have that power, you know, what does that look like? And are we better going fishing for something we don't know versus what we know we have now?
Well, that for sure is always that. I mean, that's the base of any hiring question is like, do we deal with the one that we got or do we take our chances? Well, you have to weigh that out. I think moving forward, it all goes back to the team and what the team sees the vision of the school being in general. And when you go for that hiring process, there are very, just like you walk into a classroom and know the wittiness of the teacher, you know for sure in the middle of the interview, whether they know education or not, you know that they have that it factor that aligns with what you want the school to be. And if you're creating a community and a situation where relationships are the foundation for building a school and in that climate and community going forward, you know in that interview, 9 times out of 10, whether they fit that profile or not. So I would take someone in that with that mindset who doesn't have any idea about education in general, willing to learn, over someone who comes in and knows their craft but couldn't care less about climate culture and building the relationships at a school. So I think that has something to do with it too. And I think taking track records is a lot when you do tons of classroom visits and walks like we do. We're in classrooms all the time. You know what teachers you want to have on your crew moving forward because they align and they're willing to build those relationships in the classrooms and actually move kids in that way in the room. But then they're also willing to contribute to the overall family and climate and culture of the school itself, because you can't do it, you know, well only in the classroom. There has to be a greater community involved. And I think as administration and moving forward on interviews and the way that whole thing shakes down, we do have a teacher shortage that is a huge problem. So, but I don't know that any of us at our school or any school that I've worked at willing to just take whomever because they happen to have a pulse. I don't think that's ever anyone's, you know, purpose for hiring. But when you get to pick and choose or when you get to be selective in situations where relief schools are opening up or other opportunities become available within the district, those are conversations that you have, and they're tough to have. They're awkward. And sometimes it has to come from coaches and come from resource people because we're colleagues talking to colleagues, not assessing administrators talking to teachers. And to say, you know, this may not be right for you. This school might not be the right fit. You know, teaching might not be right for you. Like, let's talk about what other options we have in life. But that, you know, I think it goes back to knowing where you want the school to go and what the purpose and the vision is overall for the school. And then pulling people on the team that align with that vision, I think, is huge. And to have that ability and to be able to, in a situation, to make those decisions is hugely beneficial. And when you work at a school that is high functioning and it is a great area and has traditionally scored very, very well, and kids leave here better than they came to us, you have a little bit of leeway to be a little bit more picky choosy with who you get to hire. Yeah. And that definitely is a benefit.
Cool. Yeah, I like it. You know, I think it's not an easy choice. It's not an easy plan, but I think it's, you know, it's something that reflective component, I think, is really critical, like you said, and that's going out and talking to people and asking for people. And the more we help with that perception, the more choices we have in who we're hiring. So I think they all sort of weave together. I like it. I think it's a beautiful bow to wrap it all up with.
You're welcome. No, I wasn't expecting it to align that way, but it did. So,
cool. Well, Jackie, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. As people will have heard, this is literally like bells going off in the middle of the day. I'm trying to put this together. So I really appreciate you carving out the time for me. If my audience wants to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you? Do you do like the Twitter thing? You have anything?
You know, from the teacher world, I don't tweet. It's there. It's my, separate life in photography. So NFL photography. Yeah, no, NFL photography.
Cool.
Instagram.
Yeah, check it out. Absolutely. And a soon-to-be website, a backup again.
That's one of these days.
One of these days.
I might know a guy that can help with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jackie, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And have a great day.
Thanks.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining me on the show. To connect with Jackie, you can check out her photography at her Facebook page and her website. Links are in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Shrepler. I love to hear from you guys there, and it's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website, which gives options as well, which you can find at bradshrepler.com/feedback. Until next week, go talk to someone on your campus and pick their brain.
Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.